The Montessori always says, if you want change, look to the young child. But if we want change in the young child, we must change ourselves. So.
Bienvenue sur le podcast pour un plein épanouissement affectif et cognitif. Un podcast pour les parents, les professeurs et les éducateurs Montessori qui veulent plonger dans les neurosciences et la pédagogie Montessori. Je suis Céline Guerrero, maman, prof des écoles en dispo, réalisatrice de ce podcast et prête à tout pour que chaque enfant développe son plein potentiel. Pour ce faire, je forme les adultes à la pédagogie Montessori et je propose des outils aux parents et aux enfants qui sont scolarisés en école traditionnelle. Vous pourrez découvrir ma formation Montessori Neuroéducation sur mon blog montessori-apprendreautrement.com. J'ai également la chance de travailler avec l'équipe d'ERA Montessori. C'est un organisme de formation qui propose des formations de grande qualité avec un accompagnement pédagogique individualisé. Pour devenir éducateur Montessori, rendez-vous sur formationeramontessori.com. Je crée aussi des outils pour les parents et les enfants des écoles traditionnelles. Mon programme « Apprendre à apprendre à la maison pour mieux réussir à l'école » et « Je mémorise la conjugaison » s'adresse aux enfants du CE1 au CM2. Si ce podcast vous plaît, je compte sur vous pour partager les épisodes qui vous plaisent avec vos amis et vos collègues et pour laisser un commentaire sur votre plateforme d'écoute. Et une note de 5 étoiles si vous êtes sur Apple Podcast. C'est la meilleure solution pour donner de la visibilité au podcast et contribuer vous aussi à développer le plein potentiel de chaque enfant. Pour ce 109e épisode, j'ai eu la chance d'échanger avec Uma Ramani, une éducatrice AMI et formatrice AMI. Uma est formée en 3-6 et en 6-12. Elle est née en Inde et travaille depuis des années aux États-Unis. Cet épisode est donc en anglais. Uma est la directrice de la formation 3-6 à Dallas, au Texas. Je lui ai posé plusieurs questions pour découvrir son parcours et ce qui lui a donné envie de devenir éducatrice Montessori puis formatrice. Nous avons échangé sur la transformation de l'adulte, le pouvoir de l'observation, les périodes sensibles, l'esprit absorbant, et comment on peut réduire les coûts d'un environnement Montessori. Je laisse place à ma conversation avec Uma. Hello Uma, it's a huge pleasure for me to be talking to you today.
It's wonderful, Céline, and I'm so glad. It's an honor to be invited and to join you today and discuss Montessori, my favorite topic, right?
Can you introduce yourself and tell us about your daily work?
Yes, my name is Uma Ramani, and I'm a AMI trainer at the 3-6 level. I was born and brought up in India, and that was in India that I did my training over 40 years ago. Yeah, and I trained with two men. And both these men had trained with Dr. Montessori. I trained one of them was Albert Max Houston. His mother was also Montessorian. He was a Dutchman, and he actually grew up in the Montessori household, basically. And then when Montessori left India, she sent Mr. Houston to India to be her personal representative because she realized there was so much work that still needed to be done in India. So he was designated as a personal representative in India, and he carried on her work in India. And joining him in that work was another young man, Mr. Swami. Mr. S.R. Swami trained with Montessori's in Kodaikanal.
Oh, great.
And then after training there, he had started his own school. And so when Mr. Houston came in the 50s to India, he joined him in continuing the work of training in India and expanding the work in India. So, you know, they bought a wonderful gift that they gave me about the spirit of Montessori and the purpose of Montessori and her vision is something that still informs me in my work today. Yeah. So, and for the last 25 years, I've lived in the United States. I currently train at the Montessori Institute of North Texas, that's based in Dallas. And I've been there since 2014 as a trainer and initially offered a summer training there, you know, the U3 summer training that most people are familiar with that format. But in 2019, I had been working since 2018 with a group of people at AMI Global to format a new kind of training that would make AMI training accessible to more people. So we had worked on designing a more blended format course so that people didn't have to be away from home for so long, or they could access the training while they were still working full time. And so in 2019, I piloted that course at Mint, and Mint was very supportive of starting something that was so different, and without their support, I could not have done it. And AMI, on behalf of AMI, it was an honor to be able to try something that was so different, you know, to carefully design a course in a very different format that would still be as rigorous and it's a high fidelity course that focuses on the core of what AMI training is, you know. So it was very carefully crafted. And so since 2019, I've been offering this blended format training in Dallas. And this is my third course that I'll just be completing in July. And then we have a fourth course that will be starting in June. So this is something that I've been working, I do on a daily basis. So, you know, being in a blended format training has made my days look different, you know, because I work with people who are in the classroom full time. So we meet with them. I work with a group of people because, again, this is something what was very intentional, that a training like this needs to have a diverse group of people who are supporting this training, right? So they hear a unified voice, but we have a diverse group. So I have a co-trainer with me. Her name is Bethann Slater. So she's there. And we have two trainers in training who work with us, Caroline Clark and Helen Moen Elias. And so we are really a very diverse group of people. And along with that, we have some veteran teachers in the community who support the work by reviewing the students' work and working with them and talking to them. So it's a group of people who offers this training. And so my work is coordinating and discussing and kind of consulting with everybody to make sure the course is going smoothly. But also, since a lot of our content is offered online, yes, we try to make sure that is honed and it is appropriate. Because it's like the Montessori prepared environment of the classroom. You know, we prepare the environment, we've got things done online, but then we always look at what are we seeing the students? What do we need to tweak? You know, what activity would be better? What a different kind of presentation might be better. So we are constantly sharing our observations and tweaking that. And then while we meet with the students live twice a week, they are working online. So we have other times when we meet with students individually. And of course, this works around their time. So my day is quite often starts early and goes late because in the middle of the day, they are busy with their being in the classroom. But it's a very individualized program that really supports everybody in taking what they're learning straight to the classroom, because they're all working full time. It's not something that I train and then go to the classroom, right? So that's my day. In addition, in between, I'm filled with other work that I do for AMI Global. I'm part of the Scientific Pedagogy Committee. I work with the AMI ESF initiative. So those are other things, a few other things that fill up my day. Yeah.
Great. I love this idea of prepared environment to help teachers to work online. You know, I try to deploy it in a lot of schools. I'm a big proponent of Montessori education, so I try to deploy it in a lot of schools by training traditional teachers. I'm not an AMI educator, but it doesn't prevent me from helping many teachers, and I'm doing it online. So I love this idea of prepared environment.
It's funny. That's our principles, right? We have to take our principles and implement it. Yeah.
Avant d'écouter la prochaine question que j'avais posée à mon invité, je voulais vous partager mon état d'esprit et vous emmener dans les coulisses du podcast. J'ai publié le premier épisode en novembre 2019. Et depuis, j'ai publié plus d'une centaine d'épisodes. Donc je prends beaucoup de plaisir à échanger avec mes invités et je suis ravie de savoir toute la valeur que cela vous apporte. Le nombre d'écoutes augmente, mais je m'essouffle un peu. J'ai du mal à suivre le rythme, voilà, un épisode par semaine. Toutes mes activités bénévoles me prennent beaucoup de temps et d'énergie, Donc vous pouvez faire le calcul, hein, plus de 100 épisodes, entre 4 et 5 heures de travail par épisode. Donc aujourd'hui, j'ai besoin de votre soutien. Si vous écoutez régulièrement le podcast, et si vous êtes conscient de la valeur que cela vous apporte, vous pouvez soutenir mon travail en vous abonnant pour 5 euros par mois. Vous trouverez le lien dans les notes de chaque épisode. Et cela vous permettra de participer à une visio questions-réponses de l'accompagnement 2 heures pour ma classe. Allez, retournons à notre épisode du jour.
I'm wondering, why did you choose to become a Montessori educator and a Montessori trainer?
Well, I was introduced to Montessori's work when I was still in school. My father was a voracious reader, and he really was exploring the work of different educators. So from very young, I was exposed to, many alternative education theories and ideas of education. And one of the early books he brought me is The Discovery of the Child. I still have it here, and I still use that regularly. And so, her work and her approach to education appealed to me right from a very young age. And then, so of course, it influenced my choice of work that I chose to do. But as I entered my fourth plane and I said, okay, what do I want to do? And at 19, I went off and did the training, So it was a very young age, and I had two phenomenal trainers who really helped me understand this work well. But it was a good thing I did not go straight into the classroom for many years after that. I did work with the training center as an assistant. I did other work supporting training. I worked with schools, in some capacity. I became a mother, and then I said, I was 19 when I did this. I did want to study other things. So I went off and I did other studies. So I only started working full time in a Montessori classroom 17 years after I did my training. And when I came to the United States and my children were 4 and 11, that's when I started working full time in the Montessori classroom. Before that, it was all either substitute or support or working at other levels. But when I left India and I went to see Mrs. Swami, he made me promise. He said, "You're also leaving India. Who's going to carry on this work?" So I sort of promised him that I would become a trainer and carry on this work. So, that was at the back of my mind for many years. And so in 2008, I decided, okay, the time has come. I need to do this. So 2007, actually, I entered the training of trainers. And I became a trainer in 2010 because there's so much work to be done on behalf of children. And if we want to serve children, we need prepared adults. And so by becoming a trainer, I could reach more children and families just by having and helping more adults become aware of the child and their needs and their rights. Yeah, so that's what inspired me to become a Montessori trainer. Yeah.
Great. And you already said it, so you have international experience as an educator or as a trainer?
Both, actually, because I have worked in India initially, but not full-time in the classroom. I would go for a short period of time. When I came to the U.S. in 1997, I started working full-time in the classroom, and as a trainer, I have worked in the U.S. I continue to do work in India for the community-rooted education. I've done assistant courses. I've done foundation courses for the elementary training. I've done that in Europe, in Prague, in Geneva. So, it's in Archange in France. So the elementary training there. So I have worked there. So that's some of my international experience. I'm currently helping to work with a group of adults in South Africa for the community-rooted education, which is part of the Educators on Frontiers initiative of AMI. So that's something I'm doing now. So, yes.
All over the world.
I do have experience in a variety of places, yes.
Yeah. And what are the differences between those countries' educational systems?
You know what? Traditional education in every country in the world has one thing in common. It begins with the curriculum. And that curriculum is decided by some central authority, a group of experts sitting somewhere. And over time, every 5-10 years, there's a whole revision of curriculum because, you know, things, new technology has come, so curriculum has been revised. More textbooks are published and things like that. There are small changes in time and place about how the curriculum is implemented. Sometimes there's more emphasis on testing. You know, that's the case in India. Now it's a big focus in the US where, you know, standardized testing has become such a big focus. At other times, you know, they make a little bit of thing that we need to have more interactive work. You know, the children need to have some experience. But again, in throughout, there is this commonality that in all the approaches in every country in the world, teaching equals learning, they say. If the teacher teaches, the child will learn, right? That this idea that it is the child who's a learner and so it is their activity, that is not very common in most countries in the world. And in most of these countries, I just find the child is nowhere in the picture in the education field. The child is almost incidental to this whole process of education. The adult decides what to learn, when to learn, how to learn, and just communicates the curriculum, and the child becomes, if the child doesn't learn, oh, that's something wrong with the child, instead of, you know, the whole approach is all adult-centered. So that's, I don't see much differences. I see a lot of commonalities in among all the countries, yeah.
Okay.
The missing figure is the child everywhere, yeah.
And I think you helped to lay the foundations for a fully implemented Montessori program in a public school setting. Can we discuss in more detail about it?
In the public school, as we call it in the US, are the schools that are set up by the government. It's available. It's free education for all that is offered through the, through the local government agencies and school boards. So that is what is called, which is different from public schools in India, which are the private schools. In India, when we say a public school, it's like the British public schools, which are for the elite people, right? So the public schools I'm talking about is the kind of schools that have functioned within the traditional framework of education, right? So if you are funded by the local government and work under that framework, you have all those regulations and rules and, you know, expectations and all those kinds of things. So in that context, you know, how do you implement Montessori education? And again, this is the work of many people, first of all, to change that. Yes, we do. The education has to start early, especially when you work to talking about 3 to 6. Most public education in the US starts at the first grade. Now it's starting at fourth. When they're 4 years old, you know, it still does not start at 3. So that requires extra work to make sure that, that children at as young as 3 can be admitted into the program. Another challenge is mixed age grouping, you know, so because usually you have grade levels. So how do you have communicate that we need mixed ages, you know? Then how that initial investment in materials that is required, but then you don't have this ongoing materials that you need to buy, like textbooks and paper and those supplies we don't need. So the other big challenge to communicate is always the importance of the training of the adult, because you don't have trained Montessori adults ready who are also qualified to work within the government system, licensed to work within the government system. So many of them quite often are trained teachers who then train to be a Montessorian while they start this program. You know, again, my public schools often don't invest in training teachers before they start a program. They say, oh, in October we'll start a new program and I'm taking Celine as a teacher. Now Celine needs to be trained, so can you train her in the summer and then or through the year? And so that's how most of them function. So, you know, when you do get trained teachers to really help them translate Montessori pedagogy in the context of functioning within all these constraints of the regulations is something we need to do very carefully, and that needs support. So I learned a lot through this work because I'd worked in private school settings for many years. And then when I joined this public school in Connecticut, it was, I learned as much every day as the teachers to learn and to communicate with you know, with parents, with the administration, with the school, the school board administrators who were in charge of early childhood education, and with the teachers, to always keep the child at the center, and then not forget that we're serving the child, even though we have this testing or that requirements or something else come. How do we take that and apply our Montessori principles to continue serving the child, and to trust that when you do that, you will meet all the regulations, you will meet all the standards, and you will far surpass all of that. And every time when we have trusted the child and done this work with integrity, that's what it has shown. Yeah. So.
And before to know you have already did it, I prepared a question. If you were about to train traditional teachers who had never heard of Maria Montessori and her work, where would you start?
First of all, our training is all about changing our perspective, right? Our perspective on ourselves as human beings, our perspective on how we function in this world, our perspective on the child and his potential, that the child's work plays in society, our perspective on our relationship with the child. So that's the place to start. You know, it seems like it's very attractive to use a Montessori material as fancy teaching materials, and to say that our work is nothing, the materials are incidental to our work. The method is not about the materials. The method is about how we relate to the child and how we relate to the world. And so that is where I would start, you know, with most thing. And most adults always respond to this understanding that, yes, as human beings, we have these innate tendencies that guide us to do all this work that is so phenomenal. And then we have this power to interact with our environment in ways that can be beneficial to the environment and to society or not. And so we have the power to choose. And that is based on our relationship with this environment, right? And then to also say the child, it is the child. Who we are as adults is the gift of the child. If what the child, what we make it possible for the child to realize their potential more fully, then we become more fully who we can be as human beings. And that is the part that really resonates. Everything else becomes a tool for that work, right? And so that's where you start. Yeah.
And what do you like most about your job?
I love introducing people to this perspective of Montessori's education, on education as an aid to life, all life, you know, not education as a teaching of curriculum, but as an aid to realize the full potential of life, human life, as well as all other life on the planet, the interconnected, interwoven evolution of our world and ourselves. And to help to open up this new understanding of the child and their work and their place in the world.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And the Montessori teacher undergoes a transformation during her teacher training to develop the ability to see the child through fresh eyes. Can you talk about it?
So as we've been saying, our training is fundamentally about developing new perspectives on the child. Yeah, new understanding of humans and our place in this world. It is training to be somebody, a new kind of person. It's a training of to become this new kind of person, right? And that's why people say Montessori training is difficult, because it questions so many fundamental beliefs that we have to examine them, we have to challenge them, we have to then make an effort to acquire something new, very different, you know, and to make that the habitual way of looking at the world. And so that is the focus of this teacher training, you know, to acquire this new perspective on ourselves and on the world and on the child. Yeah, so in our work, really, this training is almost what you call a reflexive verb. Like when you do something, we think we are doing it to an external object, right? But this is training that is not done to you. This is training you do to yourself, right? Our training is training that we train ourselves, you know, the trainer, the course, all this just facilitates the self-formation of the adult. And that the hope is at the end of the training, this habit of self-formation becomes lifelong. It becomes innate in everything that we do. I'm constantly thinking and growing and evolving, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great. And can we review the power of observation?
So observation, again, something I think a term that we use a lot. I'd like to start with what Montessori says, that we see not only with our eyes, but also with our minds. So when our minds are open, then our eyes can see better, right? So when we acquire these new perspectives, we're able to observe with these new eyes, see the same action, but with new eyes, and have to understand it at a different level. And to quote Mr. Yostin, this such observation must accompany us like our heartbeat. This thing is not just something when I do in the classroom or when I do, when I'm in a certain place. It is a habit that we must continuously cultivate and continuously refine wherever we are. And this observation is, we are participatory observers. We are in a situation when we are observing. So to be part of something, but at the same time to be able to observe in a detached way, that is something. People like to use this word objectivity, but we cannot have objectivity in observation, because I always see with my eyes. When I see the world, it's through the eyes of Uma, right? And you see the world through the eyes of Celine, right? So it has to be subjective from that point of view. But if we can step back and observe with detachment, then we are seeing this in a way that helps us process it with a deeper, at a later time to process it. Because this observation, we quite often in our work, we talk about observing the child, observing the child, observing the child. But first of all, this observation must begin by observing ourselves. Because who is this observer, and what am I? Can I trust what these eyes are seeing? You know, so this idea to say that I'm seeing this, then to turn to my colleague and say, "What are you seeing?" So that we can get a more all-round picture, to get a proper perspective and understanding. So this observation must always be followed by reflection. Because otherwise no point just observing if we are not reflecting. And then it doesn't stop there, because Montessori always, when she saw something, she reflected and then she acted. She never said, I see that the children need this. But she went off and she did it. So for us too, it should be this observation, and we reflect and then we decide, how do we act? Do we need to act? And if so, when and how? So that kind of reflection should be there and then translate into action as appropriate action. Yeah,
it's fascinating. And from birth to age 6, Montessori talked about an absorbent mind period, when the brain effortlessly changes. Can we turn our attention to the absorbent mind period?
Yeah, it's the absorbent mind who makes us who we are. You know, we always talk about in science and in all of literature now, there's so much of research that says the first 5 years are the most important. But we don't truly, truly understand the power of this absorbent mind. You know, as Montessori says, just by living, a child becomes. And so I think this understanding of the absorbent mind is best understood in the context of the child's work in utero, right? During the prenatal period, when the child, that fertilized egg that only has potential, now takes the material, whatever materials there in the uterine environment, uses that to form themselves according to innate laws, right? And we have no say in any of this. All we can do is offer this environment that protects, nourishes, stimulates, makes sure that the right nutrients are available and for the child to access when they need it according to their innate timetable, right? And then it's a child's work. The child is active and the child creates. And then, but that work of creation is not completely neutral, because this idea of, yes, I have the basic physiological body, I still need to construct myself as a human being Our characteristic is that we have characteristic ways of moving and talking and interacting and behaving that makes us a person of a certain time and place. And so we are not born with preformed language or preformed locomotion, unlike other, you know, living things. We come out and then in context with the environment where we are in, we acquire the language of that is in there. We absorb and incarnate. I love that word incarnate, this idea that you're making flesh. And, you know, you, that idea of incarnate is making into flesh is so in tune with what neuroscience says, that when we come out, our neural system develops, our brain architecture develops in the context of our experiences in the environment, right? So that is literally creating those axons and neurons that are wiring together in context with the environment. And that can only happen in the interaction with the environment. Again, this cannot be left to the adult to direct that work, because if the adult was left to direct this work, then this work will be very much messed up. There would be, you know, the individual would not survive. So we really, again, it's something that's innate, that the child does this work of absorbing and incarnating and taking in the materials and transforming themselves into this person of this time and place. And that's the wonderful work of the absorbent mind. That is our gift, through which, you know, Dr. Montessori calls this child at this age a spiritual embryo. Because if you think about how does human language, human civilization, how is that transmitted from generation to generation? It is not transmitted through the genes. It is the child that is that agent of spiritual heredity. When the child absorbs everything, the child then uses that as the basis for continuation. Otherwise, we would always be at zero, right? Every generation would start at zero and must build up. We wouldn't have this progressive evolution of human civilization that we have witnessed over thousands of millennia, over these last several millennia, right? So the child is that agent of spiritual heredity. But it's also this absorbent mind that makes it, helps. It is also this absorbent mind that takes in all our prejudices. You know, all that, you know, we think, we absorb as a young child that children are weak, children are not very powerful. That's what I've absorbed from the environment. Children are incapable. And that is what we are working. We have to work so hard to overcome as adults. That's what the training works on. That's what, but it's a lifelong work, because even after 40 years after my training, that what the work has, the absorbent mind has taken in is so much a part of myself that there are times that I have to stop myself. That's all I can say, and that has happened, that more and more and more I'm able to stop myself and question myself when I go into that default mode of function, right? So for us, it is also an agent of way we can change, because the more we change, the more the child will see the world and less they will absorb these prejudices. So whether it's racial prejudices, gender prejudices, age prejudices, prejudices against the child, if we could just work on ourselves and make sure that what's in the environment of the child is different, what they absorb will be different. And so the child becomes that tool for change. Montessori always says, if you want change, look to the young child. But if we want change in the young child, we must change ourselves. So we change ourselves, so what's in that environment that the child uses to form themselves becomes what we worthy of, what the child of creating, becoming part of a human being for the next generation, right? And that's a lot of work and awareness on the part of adults. And that, I think, that's why the preparation of the adults is so critical.
Okay, I'm wondering, what are the risks if a Montessori educator didn't know about the absorber mind? What the consequences would be?
This awareness that everything that I do or say around that young child, right? If the consequences of not knowing that is what we can see in the world around us. Because the world, even though they say the young child is the first 5 years are most critical, what do? We we are not careful how we talk around the newborn child. We are not careful about how we interact with others and the environment around the young child. We are not conscious of, you know, the prejudices we are manifesting, the way we behave around the young child. We think all that can be taught later. The child is too young. But, you know, that is the critical mistake. I mean, so when the adult is not aware of the power of the absorbent mind, and we cannot comprehend, we see every child absorbing the language, absorbing, moving, absorbing the behavior patterns of the life around them. But it is so, it's every child does it. So it is, we really don't see it as a miracle, but this idea, how does this happen? I mean, we have to bring that awareness of this awe-inspiring work this child does that we are incapable of. Because if we do not aware, then the consequences are for us to see around us, right? So it's not just the Montessori educator. I think all adults must become aware of this. And this is the result is that we don't even invest as a society in that young child. There is very little. I know it's different in France, but you know, in the US, there's very little investment in early childhood care. There's very little support for parents in the early child, in the first years of life. Even maternity leave is something that we are still fighting hard to get. You know, maternal and child health is not attended to. So right when that being is in that, it's most sensitive and most vulnerable, we are not supportive of the child and the family, because the child and the family are a unit. The child needs that, and that support is critical. And so the consequence of not being aware of the absorbent mind is, yeah, it's there in the world for around us. Yeah.
Thanks. And can we discuss in more detail the concept of sensitive periods and the prepared environment?
So the sensitive periods are a critical and necessary corollary to the absorbent mind, because the absorbent mind is global. It just takes, gathers. But if some specific organs need to be formed, just like in utero, when, you know, cells are multiply, and then to form the different organs, they sort of coalesce around certain pointers, and then certain cells change their character and become the nerve cells. Some cells change their character and become blood cells or become bone cells and things like that. So around a certain kind of a point of sensitivity, they coalesce to create these organs, right? And that is what the sensitive periods does for the absorbent mind. The absorbent mind is the gatherer of, it's like that multiplying undifferentiated cells. But then around the sensitivities around language, everything around language coalesces, and around the sensitive around. So these sensitive periods are critical for this formation of these human characteristics. As Dr. Montessori said, they are the watch will guide and support the formation of the human characteristics. And that's what, when that characteristic is formed, the sensitive periods fade away. And so that is why it is critical. But again, the way, because of the plasticity of the human mind and how environment, depend on environmental experience, the functioning of the human, you know, human functioning is, having a prepared environment at all times is so critical to understand that these are all is needed, what is needed for the child in their self-formation. So in utero, you do not say, oh, the child is forming his bones, let me have some calcium. No, you keep having calcium and protein so that as the brains are formed, bones are formed, they can absorb what they need from the environment. So you cannot see the working of the sensory period. A lot of the work is done before the first manifestation of language. You know, no point talking about supporting the development of language after the child has begun to talk. The support has to happen before, because there's so much that happens in the formation of the organ, learning to move the mouth. And if that time we stick a pacifier in the mouth and the child is not able to exercise their muscles of their tongue and their cheek and the mouth and their throat to form the different voices, then when the child is 1.5, we wonder why the child is not articulating properly or enunciating properly. If we stick the pacifier in the mouth and stick the child in front of a screen, And we just to keep them busy, we don't have any interaction with the child. The child has limited interaction with human beings. And we wonder why the child has not acquired language. Well, language is in the child only absorbs what is alive in the environment. He's not going to absorb from a screen. So, you know, this understanding that the sensitive periods requires a prepared environment for us to be aware that they function and their work is vital in the formation of these organs, then becomes helps us then to keep the environment prepared to meet the needs of the sensitive periods. So that this is, again, very different. You know, in neuroscience, when they talk about sensitive periods now, they talk about it as windows of opportunity. In during the sensitive periods, you can input more things. Again, coming from this idea of teaching, because the adult is the formative person, right? So we can stuff things inside to form the child into something else. But Montessori, when she wrote about sensitive periods, you know, 50 years, 70 years before the idea of sensitive periods entered so in neuroscience, she wrote about sensitive periods based on biology. And she wrote about it back in 1926 based on the work of people in the field of botany and of zoology to say that these are what sensitive periods do. And so she sees that sensitive period is the imperative comes from within the child. And if the environment is ready, the child can take. It's not that the environment responds after seeing the sensitive period. You know, it's not as if the environment is entering in because there's a sensitive period, but because the sensitive period is innate. If the response appropriate needs materials, then the environment, the sensitive period will reach out. So it's an innate motivation. And it is so, again, this is something where our perspective as Montessorians on something on the observant mind, on the sensitive periods, is very different from what is out there in the field of education and in neuroscience and child development and psychology.
It's so interesting. Yeah. And can we talk about this principle? Every unnecessary help is an obstacle to the child's development.
I think this comes back to this understanding that we are not the child's makers. And we always, when we come with this idea, I love the child, I want to help and make sure everything's perfect for him, it's with this idea that if I don't do it, the child will not be able to do it. And so quite often when the child who is in this path of self-formation has an innate guide to do it, because we are unaware, we want to help, we go in and get in the way of the child's work. And when we stop the child's work, then of course their development is impacted. They cannot do their work of self-formation the way they are guided by their innate needs. And so when in doubt, stay out. You know, do not step in and do, you know, just observe. Again, it comes back to observation. Say, do I need to step in now or not? Is the best help I offer is stepping back and letting be, right? So that is... Yeah, very difficult for us to hold ourselves back because I can do it so much better and more efficiently and quicker for the child. And when I do everything for the child, then the child is free to go and learn the really important things. Well, the important thing is that I learn to move and take care of myself. And if you don't give me the time to do that and the support to do that, then everything else is going to be impacted, right? From, you know, we only are aware then of the child not being, you know, when his literacy is impacted or his numeracy and then the test scores are impacted, then we act. But no, that comes back, you know. I think you had, you talk about executive functioning, this ability to be able to function with autonomy, that comes through the child's work. It's the child's work of deforming themselves. And if I have the opportunity to move and interact and develop my movements, if in moving I learn more about the environment, so I have the knowledge to inform and guide my movements, if I can move around and see the consequences of my action, then my will begins to understand that, okay, I can do this, I cannot do that. If I do this, then I can make a positive impact. If I do this, then, you know, it is not such a good impact. If this awareness that I'm part of a community and my actions impact the community is there, then that translates into behaving in this environment in a way that I make choices that is good for me and the community, right? And so when we talk about, this is what Dr. Montessori is, I think, you know, what is today called executive functioning skills is really a combination of Montessori's idea of normalization, which is that integrated personality when the child is able to work with thought, will, and action in harmony. And then this integrated personality being having this feeling of belonging in this community so that when I have this normal integrated personality, I can contribute to this community and I can serve the needs of myself and the community in appropriate ways, right? So this choice. So this is a Montessori, my interpretation of this idea of executive functioning, which is talking about, you know, the air traffic control system and how we are able to judge and choose and all those kinds of things is how the science is explained. But in practicality, this is what we see manifested. And this idea of this making these choices is really in tune with Montessori's idea of that integrated personality, because our actions are informed by, guided by our intelligence and motivated by our will. Our choices are motivated by the will. Our choices are guided by our intelligence and the capacity to do things. So this integration of personality, this normalization of that individual is critical to this work. And so that's where, again, if we become impediments to this work of development and self-formation, then we are right there, we are stopping all of this. And that has impact for the individual, but also for society.
Great. And online in India, I saw a picture of recycled posters, which became classified vocabulary cards. How can we reduce the costs of setting up a quality Montessori prepared environment?
So that has been our focus for the, in the AMA. AMA has this whole wing for the Educators on Frontiers, Educators Without Borders. The idea is that, you know, Montessori's work evolved beyond the Montessori method very quickly. From the beginning, she had talked about, she made this about the rights of the child. And then eventually it became the rights of all humans and all living beings, right? It's, that is what she called the education as a life. So what is Montessori education then? You know, I always, the question would come, can you start an environment without school? Can you have a Montessori environment without materials? And I would say, absolutely. And I would also add a corollary, can you have an environment that is not a Montessori environment, which has every Montessori environment beautifully arranged, but it's not a Montessori environment? Absolutely. Because the Montessori practice is about the spirit of Montessori, which is respect for the child and freedom for development. That is where she talks about this freedom for development and the conditions of life. She said, all you have to do as adults is offer the conditions of life. And the conditions of life for the young child is the conditions of freedom to follow that natural laws of development, especially in this first plane, right? When it is throughout life, but definitely in the first plane, when it is so much of the work is done on the non-conscious level and cannot be dictated by the adult, that it becomes critical. And so when you talk about setting up a Montessori environment, it doesn't start with the class materials. It starts with the prepared adult. And if you have the prepared adult, then everything else is possible. So you saw this material as part of what we call developed as community-rooted education. And that's a ESF initiative that we piloted in a community in India. And now we are working in South Africa with it. But really, it is this idea that as adults in the community, we can come together to support the needs of the child. And we use what's in the, available in the community, the resources of the community, to offer what the child needs. And that what that is doesn't look the same in every place in the world, because what the building looks like is different from what it looks like in Timbuktu versus in China, where it is in the US, right? What the materials look like, again, what is available locally that we can use based on our principles, right? And so in India, for example, a lot of the early childhood education, we have a beautiful policy framework that set up this early childhood care and education based on Montessori principles, because she was there before the independence and many of the people who trained with her were instrumental in setting up that policy framework. And we have this early childhood education centers throughout India in every village called Anganwadis, right? And many of the materials they are offered are Montessori materials. You look at their handbook, they are follows a lot of the Montessori principles. The language materials are all offered in classifications, fruits, vegetables, beautifully done. But they're offered, as you said, in posters. So when you have posters, then again, it's teaching again. I can stand here and point and say banana, mango, pineapple, but there is no activity for the child. If we cut it up and make it into loose cards, then we can this thing, we can use it. So again, it was using what was available in the local community to serve the needs of the child. And that began with the preparation of the adults to help them understand what is it the child needs. So can we do Montessori? Can we reduce the cost of the Montessori, for Montessori prepared environment? Absolutely we can. We just need to understand the principles so well, and whatever resources we have, we really have to invest in the preparation of the adults. Otherwise, there's no point getting on any materials at all.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Thanks. And I noticed that you are interested in neuroscience. Do you talk about it in your training program?
Just enough to show that how valid Montessori's observations were, all the theories that she developed based on her observation over years are now getting validated, so enough to introduce students to some of these concepts, enough to say that, give them current terminologies to refer to things, because parents read this and they need to be able to make those connections to what we do in the classroom. So that, because our work in training is so intense, that it's a fine balance, but enough to give them the basis for going off and continuing this work on their own. Yeah, so I do that.
I think you talked about executive functions during the podcast. Are you familiar with executive functions? And I think Maria Montessori didn't talk about it like that, but she was talking about self-control and... what are the links between her work and executive functions?
Yeah, so for me, when you say it's about self-control, that self-control, as she said, comes from that integration of personality, that your intelligence, your will, your actions are all working in a coordinated manner, right? So if you say self-control, it means that I understand enough to know the actions and their consequences, and I am invested enough that I can make the right choice that's right enough, not only for me, but for the community. So, this idea of self-control is rooted in her idea of normalization, or that integration, which is really where she's talking about this integration of personality, and this idea of social cohesion, that the child absorbs that they are an integral part of the community they are in. And so then, as this autonomously function, a child with agency, a child who has developed that autonomy, then is able to make choices, not just for themselves, but in the context of the group. So, yeah, so this is where I see the alignment. And so, again, this is, again, one of those terms that I do introduce in my training, but with this interpretation of where does this come from and how important, for example, are our exercises of practical life in supporting this work? Because that is the root, that's where the normalization happens, that integration of personality that happens, where I function as a member of a community, as a contributing member of a community. And how important is that then, even in a larger impact, that if each of us understood that we are part of a larger interdependent whole, then the world will not be in such a mess as it is today, right?
So. What do you want to share that I haven't asked you?
I think I sort of integrated a lot of that in, as we were talking, you know, in terms of the understanding that, you know, we really, Montessori inspired us to go out of our classrooms and work on behalf of the child, children's rights in society, in community. And I think that's the work that we all must embrace. And we cannot be comfortable in our classrooms just doing what we are doing. We need to take this understanding of the child, be these interpreters of the child everywhere, and to make our voices heard on behalf of the child so that they become a recognized member of the society, that their rights are as valid as the rights of adults, right? And that becomes even more and more critical, because the thing is, the number of children being born in the world as a ratio to the adults is reducing every day. And so they were 50% of the population 50 years ago. Now they are less than 25% of the population. And in many countries where the population has a negative growth, that means there are not enough children coming in. So if we have to serve the child if we want to support the survival of human beings and the survival of our world, of the earth as such, and support them. You following Montessori principles, understanding that we are all part of an interdependent society and interdependent cosmic whole. And so that is what I would like to emphasize. Yeah.
Great. I will end this amazing interview by asking you the usual three questions. Do you want to share a quote about education, obviously?
Yes. So, you know, my trainer, Mr. Swami, said, ours is a revelatory exercise, a revelatory environment. Our education, the work of education, is a revelatory work. And, you know, I came across this quote of Montessori that where she talks about, you know, she writes in this that suppose that we have a diamond embedded in a dull matrix and that we remove the surrounding material to reveal the bright jewel. Seeing the jewel, some might think, how have you gone about obtaining a precious stone that reflects the light so perfectly? We would reply that we are not the creators of this marvelous jewel. It already existed, buried deep within the extraneous matter surrounding it. The same can be said of the child. So if we help this revelation of that inner human being, of innate human potential, that's our work. Ours is not a formative work. Ours is a revelatory work.
Great. Do you have a book to share with my listeners?
I have a book which is not a Montessori book or an education book or any of that. It is a book that it's almost like a child book for children, but it's really many books of these children for children as are books for adults. So there is this book called What Do You Do With an Idea? Right? And it's written by Kobi Yamada. And she talks about how when you have an idea, you must do something with it, because with an idea you can change a world. Uh-huh. And so I would ask everybody to read. We have a beautiful idea that was shared to us by Montessori, and she shared her idea with the world. And now we have to go ahead and share that idea with more and more people so it can grow and change the world.
Oh, perfect. Uma, I will ask you a last question. What has brought you a lot of joy or anger lately?
Joy, again, it is working with adults and intimately who are working with children every day and for young families every day. That's what brings me joy. There is no time or energy for anger in our work. Montessori was an optimist and she was always doing, right? So we need to keep that, especially as our world is going more and more into things that disturb us. And the only way we can keep our equanimity, keep our focus, is to go to that one unchanging thing, which is the child, and he will guide us to a better place. So, yeah, the child always. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Uma.
You're welcome, Céline. It was a pleasure.
Si vous avez conscience qu'un changement de posture est nécessaire et si vous cherchez du soutien pour faire évoluer votre pratique vers la pédagogie Montessori, l'abonnement mensuel 2 heures pour ma classe vous permettra de découvrir les piliers de la pédagogie Montessori. Je vais créer des dossiers collaboratifs que vous exploiterez à votre rythme. Et dans un deuxième temps, nous échangerons en visio 2 heures par mois pour répondre à vos questions et passer de la théorie à la pratique, d'où le nom 2 heures pour ma classe. Vous trouverez toutes les informations sur mon blog montessori-apprendreautrement.com. À la semaine prochaine!